Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Coming up on the show, the Governor's Economic Diversity Council says Wyoming's adults need to go back to school and that the state should help pay for it.
We need to find ways to underwrite or mitigate those risks that adults have to take if we truly want them to come back to college.
We will have a story about the likely bankruptcy of the 8th largest coal producer in the country, due in part to a market strategy.
What was a good and sound strategy has turned into somewhat of a problem for them.
We'll hear voices from the commemoration of the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty.
Where is the peace that it talks about in Article 1? Why isn't the Black Hills ours?
I'll also speak with Democratic U.S. Senate candidate Gary Trauner. It's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Less than half of adults in Wyoming have completed education beyond high school. But Governor Matt Mead says for the sake of Wyoming's economy, that must change. In fact, his first executive order of 2018 called for 67% of Wyomingites to have advanced degrees by 2025. Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson takes a look at what it will take to meet this goal.
If you build it, you will come.
Building a skilled workforce for jobs that don't exist yet in Wyoming might sound risky. But Joe Schaefer, president of Laramie County Community College, like Governor Matt Mead, is confident that more workers with certificates, associates, and bachelor's degrees will bring opportunity to the state.
When businesses are looking at Wyoming, do I want to come there? They want to see a population of individuals that can fill the jobs they have. And we've got examples even in the last year where we've lost major prospects, major employers, because we didn't have that ready-made, you know, population.
Schaefer pointed to a recent report showing that CEOs are more interested in an educated workforce than the tax breaks that Wyoming currently touts. Smucker's seriously considered Cheyenne as the location for a new food processing facility, but the company went to Longmont, Colorado instead to fill those 500 positions. They were looking for workers with certificates in integrated technology systems. In other words, experience maintaining and operating complex machines. Schaefer is co-chair of a state task force that's been awarded funding and consulting support from the Western Interstate Commission of Higher Education to boost worker training and educational attainment. He says one thing Wyoming has to contend with is the energy industry.
Wyoming has one of the highest wages on average for low-skilled or semi-skilled employment. So if you want to make a good living without a college credential, Wyoming still continues to be one of the states where you can do that.
But it comes with its booms and its busts. The last downturn significantly cut public funds, drove workers out of the state, and got policymakers seriously looking at ways to stabilize things. Diversifying the economy has been promoted by Governor Mead as the path forward, hence the need for an educated and innovative workforce. But how will the state go from 48 to 67%?
In Wyoming, we have about 5,400 high school graduates a year. About half of them go on to college.
That's Mary Aguayo. She oversees the transfer student program at UW and also serves on the Educational Attainment Task Force. She says encouraging high school graduates to complete an advanced degree is critical, but only part of the picture.
When we talk about shifting the entire workforce of the state, we will never achieve the goal if we ignore the fact that Wyoming has over 80,000 working adults who have some college and no degree. There's an additional 40,000 working adults with associate's degrees and no bachelor's degree.
Aguayo says this is where Wyoming will get the most bang for its buck, because adults with roots in Wyoming are more likely to stick around once they complete their degrees.
And so what we need to do now is understand, so what do we need to do to make it appealing for those adults to reengage?
Schaefer again. He says adults with car payments, mortgages, and kids to feed go back to school when skills and knowledge clearly lead to jobs with higher wages, which Wyoming can't yet guarantee. But the task force is looking at a state-sponsored financial aid program to encourage adults to go back to school. The state already has the Hathaway Scholarship, which encourages Wyoming high school graduates to go to UW or community college, but the Hathaway is merit-based and unavailable to adults. Schaefer says the state has to make financing school easy if it's asking adults and their families to take a risk to help transform the state's economy.
And so while we're developing an economy that's diversified and has those opportunities, we need to find ways to underwrite or mitigate those risks that adults have to take if we truly want them to come back to college. And the way you do that is through financial aid, financial assistance.
Bailey Nowak is an honor roll business student at Laramie County Community College, where she's president of the campus Rotary Club. She's also owned her own lawn mowing business since she was 12 years old. And next fall, she heads to the University of Wyoming to start on a bachelor's in marketing or management. While she's clearly a go-getter, there wasn't much talk about scholarships at her home. Her parents weren't familiar with the process because neither of them had gone to college. And she doesn't remember being encouraged to apply for the Hathaway at school.
Well, for example, this is a prime example. It was my brother didn't know about the Hathaway. And we're the same age. We're twins.
Luckily, she met the requirements to qualify, but her brother did not. And while Bailey Nowak has had the financial stability to fully immerse herself in college and find her passion for business, she's watched her brother struggle to find meaning in his work, switching from construction to car tire sales to commercial driving. Like Bailey, her brother was also a young entrepreneur with his own welding business in high school, and she thinks college could help him get back that creative entrepreneurial spirit.
Go take a few classes, go try business, go try welding.
Maybe get a job in Wyoming's emerging aerospace industry. But he says he can't afford it, and that cobbling together federal aid and multiple scholarships feels too complicated.
If he just had a little more financial stability to let him know that, hey, the money's there. You don't feel like you don't have the ability to go to college because you can't afford it. I think if there's some aid, that allows you to take a little more risk.
Which could provide the workforce for the kinds of industries Wyoming is trying to recruit. Government contractors who build high-tech robots or blockchain technology. Joe Schaefer, Mary Aguayo, and the other members of the Educational Attainment Task Force are working with stakeholders to conceptualize a program that could support the thousands of students in Brandon Nowak's position. Wyoming is one of just a few states that doesn't already have a need-based aid program for adults. But hustling to catch up with the rest of the nation has its benefits. The task force will be able to look at what's worked well in other states as it crafts its plan. Legislation could go before lawmakers as soon as 2019. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
The eighth largest producer of coal in the country may soon face bankruptcy. Westmoreland Coal Company's stock has been in free fall over the last year, and several of its primary customers are moving away from coal. With one of its mines right here in the state, Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports what bankruptcy could look like.
Westmoreland Coal Company has been having some trouble lately. To get a sense of how far the company's fallen, I pulled a coworker into a studio here at Wyoming Public Radio. Anna Rader works on our website. Anna, do you know anything about Westmoreland Coal Company?
No.
On my computer, I showed her a chart of the company's stock price on NASDAQ over the last 5 years.
Yikes.
So what does that look like to you?
It's like an upwards hill, and then you're just continually going downhill until you're at the very bottom.
After a 97% drop in share price over the last year, the company was delisted from NASDAQ on April 25th. A pretty big hit to the company's reputation. And that chart is just the beginning of the company's issues.
Well, what happened?
Before we get there, some background. Westmoreland Coal Company operates mines in 5 states, including Wyoming and Canada. Over the past 5 years, Westmoreland's debt has increased 225%. The company has produced 7% less coal, saw a CEO step down, and recently hired restructuring or bankruptcy advisors.
It's kind of a sad situation.
That's Andy Blumenfeld, an analyst with Doyle Trading Consultants who studies energy markets. To him, it's clear all signs point to bankruptcy.
It seems like a very high probability.
Westmoreland is struggling financially for many reasons. Bad luck with big investments, competition from natural gas, and a market strategy with almost no flexibility. That strategy, called mine mouth, is when a mine directly feeds a power plant. It also means reliance on a few or even one big customers with long-term contracts.
The idea is to remove some of the market volatility and have a secure customer. What has turned out to be a good and sound strategy has turned into somewhat of a problem for them.
It's a problem now because more and more utilities are moving away from coal, the cheaper alternatives like natural gas. And if your one big customer suddenly doesn't need your product, that hurts. In 2016, Westmoreland bought a mine in New Mexico for $121 million tied to a generating station, the mine's primary customer.
And that's, of course, now is not going to come through.
Because soon after, the station announced it would move half its units away from coal. In Wyoming, the Westmoreland Kimmer Mine's main customer will transition its largest generator either to natural gas or completely offline within the year. The same thing is happening in Montana and Canada.
We're seeing a large stroke of bad luck in terms of the customers that they decided to hitch their wagon to, as it were.
Colorado School of Mines Ian Lang says mine mouth operations also aren't the easiest to sell.
Mine mouth plants in general don't have rail access. They're there for the plant. And so if the plant's not there, then there's no point in sort of the mine being there. You either have to build a rail line out there, which is not easy, try to truck the coal somewhere, but that's pretty expensive, or you find some other way to get the coal out.
Understandably, all of this is having an impact. Much less cash on hand and over $1 billion in debt. Bankruptcy could arrive as soon as a big enough debt payment comes the company just can't afford.
If they don't have the cash on hand to make the payment, then they're in default.
One big debt payment is coming on May 15, with several more at the beginning of next year. The company expresses doubt in an SEC filing if it will be able to meet those obligations when they're due. If bankruptcy does occur, its impacts could be far-reaching, both for the company and the communities and states it serves. Head of the Wyoming Sierra Club chapter, Connie Wilbert, says the state could be affected by reclamation costs. She says the company does have surety bonds, but she wonders if it's enough.
Because if their surety bonds are inadequate, then taxpayers will be stuck with whatever's left.
Westmoreland has around 3,000 employees in about 25 locations in the U.S. and Canada. Lincoln County in southwest Wyoming relies heavily on the Kimmer Mine. It's the largest generator of tax revenue in the area by far. And around 280 people also rely on the mine for a job.
These people are worried clear sick about it.
That's Mike Delpez, who represents these employees through the United Mine Workers of America. He says they're not just nervous about losing their jobs, but pensions and health care.
The risk depends on the type of filing.
Delpez says layoffs are also a real possibility because the biggest generating unit, the power plant, is moving away from coal, significantly reducing demand. Tom Crank is a state representative for the area. He says if workers do lose their jobs, the local community won't be able to help out. They're reliant on the mineral industry, too, after all.
It's got everybody here, you know, fairly nervous when you have small communities that are dependent on that stuff, when the big industries that provide most of the income to the community are facing issues. Nobody starts investing in the town, and so you have a hard time just keeping the other things going.
Lincoln County commissioners are currently in talks with Westmoreland about moving forward. Wyoming Public Radio reached out to the company multiple times to no response. As of April 2nd, the search for a new CEO has been suspended as the company considers filing for bankruptcy. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
When we come back, a visit with U.S. Senate candidate Gary Trauner. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Democrat Gary Trauner announced earlier this year that he is seeking the U.S. Senate seat currently held by Senator John Barrasso. Trauner lost two previous bids for federal office, losing to Barbara Cuban and Cynthia Lummis in the U.S. House race. Trauner has lived in Wyoming for 28 years and has been active in Teton County in a variety of roles, including chief operating officer at St. John's Medical Center, co-founder and chief financial officer of OneWest.net, that's a regional internet service provider, and was the vice president of finance of Teton Trust Company, that was one of the first private trust investment firms in the state of Wyoming. Trauner is also a former school board chairman and is currently the executive director of the Jackson Hole Youth Lacrosse Club. He joins us to discuss some of his views.
Maybe start off a little about our extractive industries and some of the regulations that we've seen changed and the endorsement by, I think, the entire delegation of backing out of climate change policies, that kind of thing. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, we're an energy state, and we probably always will be an energy state to some extent. I think that it's important for us to move out of the boom-bust cycle that we've been in for as long as most of us can remember here in this state. And to me, that means diversification. So I tell people, look, if you want to stop digging coal tomorrow, turn off the lights, turn off your heat, you know, turn off your air conditioning in the summer, because it still provides 30 plus percent of our electricity. But I think the free market is actually telling coal and other conventional sources that we're moving in a different direction. And to me, this is an opportunity. It's not something that's scary. It's not something that's bad. It's an opportunity for Wyoming and this country to diversify our energy sources, maintain our leadership role in this country and in the world in how we develop and provide energy and in the economy of tomorrow, because that's where it's going to be. And the side benefit, or maybe not even a side benefit, is I think it provides more good jobs, more stable jobs with competitive pay that can help us break out of the boom-bust cycle locally. So, you know, the market's sending signals. And I think you have people that are claim to be free market people until those signals go against what they want. And then all of a sudden they're command and control from Washington, D.C., which is what we're seeing. And so I think, fine, let's recognize what the market is saying. Let's diversify. It's not mutually exclusive. Let's continue to do coal and natural gas as responsibly as we can for our climate. But let's make sure that we move in another direction as well.
In some thinking, though, saying that Scott Pruitt isn't going to enforce this, or he's not going to do this, or we're going to move these regulations, isn't that little more than just talk? Because at the end of the day, the industry folks are saying, okay, this is what the Trump administration is saying. If the election swings in a couple of years, it's going back. So my understanding is they've been going ahead with climate policy anyway.
Well, I think they have. That's exactly right. And, you know, my concern is, I used an example, I don't know if it's exactly analogous, but I don't want the energy companies in the northeast corner of the state or in other areas of the state to become like Kodak, right? Kodak, we all bought film from Kodak. And Kodak actually invented the first digital camera. But the truth is they missed the digital boat. They didn't react quickly enough in the marketplace. And they're basically gone. They maybe licensed some royalties and patents, but that's about it. I don't want our single source energy companies to become like that, because that means jobs lost, et cetera. So I'm hopeful that at the federal level, we can provide some incentives and some push to continue on the path that is inevitable, I think, as you just said, Bob. You know, whether or not policy changes or changes back, it's kind of inevitable the direction we're moving, and help these companies to see that they can continue doing what they're doing, but move into the future as well.
Gary Trauner visiting with us today. When we last talked, we had a chance to talk about the new tax bill and the trickle-down economic approach that, right. Okay, we take away the taxes from the richer folks, we'll all benefit from it. I don't think you agreed with that approach.
I don't know if I was as strong last time, but let's face it, trickle down, it's a fraud. Okay. It's never worked and it doesn't work. It's amazing to me that the answer to everything seems to be tax cuts for wealthy people. In this tax cut bill, look, tax cuts for the middle class is a good thing. Temporary tax cuts for the middle class, but permanent tax cuts for large corporations and wealthy heirs, probably not as good a thing. And it's part of what we're calling the DC playbook. So, you know, it's what people in D.C. do. They say one thing, they do another, and they hope nobody's paying attention. So they tell you you're going to get a little bit extra in your paycheck. They don't tell you that little bit extra is going to go away someday. They don't tell you that it's permanent for the other people, the corporations and the wealthy heirs. And they hope you're not paying attention when everything changes back and those folks still get what they paid for, essentially, in D.C., what they bought and paid for with politicians, and us regular folks get screwed. And here's the way I take a look at it. I can make my kids really happy by giving them more allowance every week, right? But if I take it out of their college fund, they get short-term gratification, and then 5 or 10 years down the road, they can't go to college because there's no money left. That's what we're doing. We're blowing a bigger $1.5 trillion hole in our debt and deficits, and we're buying off people today because that's what politicians in D.C. do, and we need to get away from that.
Yeah, and it's a situation, as you said, that we've just got a report this week that the deficit is continuing to just skyrocket. Nothing has really changed, and in fact, they made it a little bit worse.
Right. It was $1.9 trillion instead of $1.5. You know, we're mortgaging our future, right? I mean, $21 trillion of debt. And let's be clear, by the way, it's not Social Security and Medicare that have done that. Right. They have their own tax system.
Or public broadcasting.
Or you know, no, not definitely not public broadcasting. So we need to find a way to be fiscally responsible. And it's amazing to me, part of the DC playbook, that the people that 2 or 3 years ago were yelling and screaming how debt was going to destroy our country seem to have no problem today increasing the debt in order to pay off their supporters.
The belief is, again, that this is going to generate revenue without tax increases. Down the line, you're a small businessman.
Doesn't work that way. No. I don't know how else to say it. It just doesn't work that way. It hasn't been shown to have worked historically. Kansas tried this just very recently on a statewide level. They reduced taxes and they ended up almost destroying their state budget and their state education department and their schools. We know it doesn't work. It's an easy sell because nobody wants to pay taxes. I don't want to pay a penny more in taxes than I have to. But the truth is, if we're going to be responsible, we have to pay our way.
Gary Trauner again visiting with us. You mentioned, I think, at the start, you had been working with St. John's Medical Center. And just I find that interesting because your former head of the organization there was very, very strong in, you know, healthcare reform, using Affordable Care Act to do some of these things. Obviously, we don't have anybody in our delegation currently that is on board, and the person you're running against probably is the most vehement against the ACA. So my guess is you would agree that there's some changes still that need to be made in the ACA. I think we all see some problems there. I'm curious what you would like to see happen there.
I'll agree with you, Bob. There probably are still some changes that need to be made in the ACA, but I start from sort of the highest goal. What's our goal in this country with healthcare, right? We don't consume healthcare the way we consume TV. We buy TV sets or gas grills, right? It's people's health. If there's one cancer drug and you've got cancer, you're going to buy that drug no matter what, even if it bankrupts you, because you want to live. It's that simple, right? And we're supposed to be good consumers, but I always joke, how can you be a good consumer when you're unconscious in the operating room? You don't know what they're using or doing or anything else, right? Healthcare is different. Now, for me, the goal is to make sure that every single person in this country has proactive, affordable access to basic quality healthcare. End of story. That's the goal. That's the overarching goal. And having helped run a hospital and been immersed in the system for a bunch of years, it's pretty clear that our administrative costs are killing us. So we need standardization. We need to make it easier to understand. We need transparency in pricing. Absolutely. But I think a lot of people don't understand the true costs. I assume, I could be wrong, Bob, but you get healthcare coverage through your job here, right?
Right, yep.
And you maybe have some kind of premium copay, but most people don't realize that their employer is paying a huge amount more. So maybe you pay, and I don't know what it is, $200 a month for your premium, but your employer is probably paying $1,000 or $1,500 more for you because it's super expensive to get healthcare. We need to bring those costs out so everybody sees, make them transparent. And I always get the argument, well, you know, you can get healthcare, you can go to the emergency room. And I tell people, you know what? I've seen it. You get a hangnail, people get a hangnail, they can't afford the $100 to go to their urgent care or their regular doctor. So they don't do anything about it. 2 weeks later, it's infected. They still can't afford to do anything about it. So they stick it in some hot salt water. Nothing happens. And then a month later, they've got sepsis and they're in the emergency room and it's a $100,000 life-threatening visit, right? A, that's not healthcare, that's triage. And B, there's no free lunch. So instead of a $100 bill, it's a $100,000 bill they can't pay and the rest of us pay for it. So we're all paying a hidden tax anyway. So it's complicated. It's not an easy situation. But every other Western country in the Western world has figured out how to give every one of their citizens access to healthcare in an relatively affordable way. We should be able to figure it out too.
Gary Trauner, where can folks find out more about you?
You can go to my website, which is www.trownerfory.com. So Trauner for Wyoming, essentially, .com. On Facebook, we're doing a lot of videos and a lot of stuff that I think is interesting while I'm on the road. So that's Facebook/Trauner4WY as well. Same on Instagram, social media. We're trying to make a big push to get to people as much as we can. And plus, I'll be in their communities traveling around like I did last time, knocking on doors, because the only way I get it is to meet people. And if I can say one last thing, I was talking to someone in Casper at the Casper Housing Authority. And at the end of our little tour, she said, you know, Gary, I've never had someone from running for your office or in your office come and want to know what we're doing. And I looked at her and it stunned me. I was like, how can you make policy if you don't know what's going on in your communities and you're not talking to people and you don't know what works well and what doesn't work and where the needs are and where the issues are? So that's what I try and do.
Gary Trauner, a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. Really appreciate it.
Coming up next, Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo asks why Senator John Barrasso has not scheduled oversight hearings on EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Despite the concern of others, Wyoming's congressional delegation says EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt has been great for the state's industries, and they don't seem too worried about all the scandals hanging over him. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
Wyoming's junior Senator John Barrasso chairs the Environment Committee, which has oversight over the Environmental Protection Agency. But he has yet to schedule a hearing with its embattled administrator, Scott Pruitt. Pruitt was dragged before two House committees last week and raked over the coals by most every Democrat and many Republicans over reports that he ordered a more than $40,000 secure phone booth to be erected in his office, lived at a lobbyist's house for a sweetheart rate, and allowed his top advisors to get huge bonuses. Still, Barrasso's committee has yet to schedule him for a hearing, even though energy reporters have pressed him for weeks over whether he has plans to bring Pruitt in.
Well, there are absolute legitimate questions that need to be answered, and we're continuing to ask those questions, getting some response. We have more questions to ask.
Barrasso denies critics' claims that he's giving Pruitt a pass.
You got to make sure that the public purse is protected, and you want to make sure that people get the accountability and the transparency that we want. And the specifics are the spending that's been done, and we've seen that, and then the other things about the emails.
Democrats say Barrasso and others in the GOP are hypocrites for allowing conservatives like Pruitt to go unchecked. Congressman Jerry Connolly of Virginia serves on the Oversight Committee and says all he hears from the GOP are crickets.
Unfortunately, this Congress has devolved into partisan non-oversight. And that's another reason why the midterm elections are going to be so important. Will we restore the constitutional obligation of the legislative branch as a separate but co-equal branch to hold the executive branch accountable, irrespective of which party controls the White House?
It's not just Democrats. Louisiana Republican Senator John Kennedy says the accusations against Pruitt are disturbing.
Ethics matter. Impropriety matters. The appearance of impropriety matters. These dollars that we all spend are precious, and they didn't just all fall from heaven. We thank heaven for them, but they come out of people's pockets. And you've got to respect taxpayer money. You can't go around just spending it like it was ditch water.
Pennsylvania Republican Congressman Charlie Dent is retiring and says the lack of oversight on Pruitt is a part of a larger trend in Washington for both parties to be hyperpartisan in recent years.
Clearly had Shubin on the other foot. You know, we'd be waving a bloody shirt, and there'd be hearings. So, unfortunately, what I've noticed with both parties over the years is that each side, kind of abides by this notion of separation of parties and a lot less separation of powers.
When asked about the allegations against Pruitt, Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney responds with this critique of his record.
Look, I think people in Wyoming are really thrilled with the policy changes we've seen, really very supportive of the policy and the substantive direction the EPA is going in.
Cheney then dives into the accusations against Pruitt, like that he's squandering taxpayer dollars on things like first-class flights and an expensive security detail.
As to the other stuff, I think obviously we want to make sure that, you know, no matter who the public servant is, they're, abiding by the most rigorous standards and levels in terms of ethics and responsible behavior.
Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins opposed Pruitt, but she says the dark cloud that now follows him wherever he goes actually undercuts his efforts at the agency.
The ethical allegations against him make it very difficult for the department to focus on its mission and are a distraction. They add to my concerns about his policy decision.
Still, Senator Barrasso says he's in no rush to drag Pruitt before his committee.
The White House is in the process of doing a formal review. The president will make an ultimate decision, but we're going to keep asking questions.
Barrasso's Democratic colleagues are wondering when they'll be allowed to ask their own questions of Administrator Pruitt. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Over the last few weeks, Native Americans from across the Northern Plains have been traveling toward Fort Laramie National Historic Site in Wyoming. They came by bus, by foot, and as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards found out, even by horse. She talked to two teenage boys from the Cheyenne River Reservation, Hyson and Angel, out riding their horses around.
So what was the ride like?
It was pretty cool, meet new people and yeah.
How long did it take you?
Took us 2 weeks to get here.
Well, why was it important to do that, ride 300 miles to get here?
For a treaty.
Yeah, for the treaty.
That'd be the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty. It was signed 150 years ago this month in hopes of putting an end to the Indian Wars of the mid-1800s, when the Northern Plains turned into a war zone. More and more settlers had moved into lands promised to the tribes in previous treaties. Around then, the pressure on the tribes to move onto reservations became fierce. But many tribes continued to resist. Then, in late April 1868, three Lakota clans and the Dakota and Arapaho came to this very spot, where the cottonwoods grow along the North Platte River. This morning, dozens of teepees sit among them. Smoke curls from campfires. Boys ride bareback through the meadows. And inside a big white tent, jam-packed with people, tribal leaders gather to recognize the broken promises of the 1868 treaty.
My name is Hollow Hornbear. We understand what this treaty did not do for us. Where is the peace that it talks about in Article 1? Why isn't the Black Hills ours when you talk about it in Article 2? Where is the education in Article 7?
Here's Cheyenne River Sioux leader Harold Frazier.
What's very upsetting, though, is to come all this way on horse. Where is Trump? Where is Zinke?
During the pipeline fight, there was these huge megaloads of pipeline equipment coming through the reservation. And my auntie here, Marie Randall, stood up in front of one of those trucks and she stopped that truck and she made them turn around. She made them turn around. Go back to Texas, she said. Go back to Texas.
Ninety-eight-year-old Lakota elder Marie Randall's adopted brother was the famous chief Red Cloud, one of the signers of the 1868 treaty. She stands in the crowd under a white flag she decorated.
I'm thankful that you're all gathering to teach your young people. Let's forget this immigration thing that's going around. Let's all be human with human thoughts, together to walk on Unchimaka peacefully.
My name is Afi Ellis, and I serve in the Wyoming State Senate. I'm Dene, a proud member of the Navajo Nation. A few years ago, I was in Washington, D.C., and I had the opportunity to visit the National Museum of the American Indian. And I saw a plaque that really struck me. It was a giant chart talking about disease and how disease wiped out millions of Native peoples. And in that moment, I just felt this overwhelming sense of pride in the fact that my family has endured so many things, down to surviving ugly diseases such as smallpox that wiped out so many of our ancestors. And it really made me feel inspired about the work that we have every day to be Indian people on this earth. I hope that today we celebrate the fact that we're simply here.
Well, good morning, good afternoon. My name is Matt Mead. I'm the governor of Wyoming. Out of respect to the tribes, I was pleased the Wyoming legislature passed a resolution in the 2018 session regarding today's commemorative event. The resolution recognizes the importance of educating people about the 1868 Treaty of Fort Laramie and the history of the place where we are gathered today. It also supports nationwide public education about the heritage, history, and contributions of Native American tribes, and asks the federal government to uphold its federal trust responsibilities.
Outside, Teenager Alexis Whitehat stands listening with her friends.
Rode up in a bus with all the youth from the Rosebud Sioux Tribe.
What's your name?
Rachel Denise.
Why did you come? Why is it important to come?
I came because I'm a descendant of one of the signers.
Roy Brown, the chairman of the Northern Arapaho Business Council. This is significant for the Arapahos in a number of ways. Being able to communicate with the federal government on a nation-to-nation basis. And sometimes tribes feel like they are bystanders in the policies and the laws that come out that affect our native communities and that affect our native way of life.
Up by the old fort barracks, artists have set up booths. Annette is selling her cousin's jewelry.
I'm Southern Cheyenne from Oklahoma. I've been hearing this over many, 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 many years. And I had a chance to come and see it, and it was just, it's like, wow.
Wait, what's your name?
Mark Powers.
And what's the name of your horse?
Chief. He's a leopard Appaloosa. Yeah, we bring some, you know, about 10 high school kids from Lower Brew. And
Why did you feel like it was important to come and to bring kids and stuff?
So they could understand what happened. And so they can pass that information on to their kids and their grandchildren.
To see photos and videos of the 1886 Fort Laramie Treaty commemoration, visit our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
When we come back, we'll hear about a Wyoming visit from musician Galen Lee. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Last week, the Wyoming Archaeological Society and the Montana Archaeological Society held a joint conference in Billings, Montana. 3 years ago, women archaeologists from both Wyoming and Montana started a group called the Sisterhood of the Traveling Trowel. The group tries to help emerging women archaeologists in their careers. Crystal Alegria and Bonnie Smith are both members of the Sisterhood and archaeologists in the Plains Country. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska speaks with both women on the need to help women archaeologists. She first asked Bonnie Smith what the group's goal was this year.
The goal this year was to pay tribute to one of our sisters, one of the founding members of the Sisterhood, Ruth Ann Knutson, who passed away about a month ago. And we are in the process of setting up a scholarship in her name that will go towards young women to help attending conferences, to help with attending field school, you know, just to help.
So the field of archaeology is now almost more dominated by women, but in the past, it was really the opposite. There weren't very many women in this field. And so over the years, with people like Ruth Ann and Alice Kehoe and all these other women, they've really done a good job of making it easier for women to be part of this field. So we, as the sisters, want to honor them and honor their work and their scholarship and their publications and in the way that they've paved for the rest of us to kind of follow behind and make it easier for us to do the work that we love to do.
Why was it important for the Sisterhood of the Trowel to honor Ruth Ann?
It was important because the Sisters of the Traveling Trowel, it was a group that Ruth Ann was a founding member of. So we kind of came up with it a few years ago, and Ruth Ann was there when we came up with that idea. And so for us, it was really important to honor Ruth Ann, not only because of that, because she was a founder of the Sisters of the Traveling Trowel, but also because she was one of those really important sisters who paved the way for other women. And Ruth Ann was tough. I mean, she had a heart of gold. She was a teddy bear underneath, but she was a tough lady, and she would tell it like it was, and she would really push her way through if she needed to. And so to me, she's like the ultimate, you know, sister of the traveling trowel, because she really, she was the way paver in a lot of ways. There's a lot of other women like Ruth Ann too, but for me, she really exemplifies what we are honoring with the Sisters of the Traveling Trowel.
Do you remember a story that she told you guys that's kind of popped out?
So we were talking with Ruth Ann. There was a group of us that were sitting together kind of reminiscing about the women who kind of came before us and who paved the way for us. And so we were talking, and Ruth Ann started talking about Marie Wormington, who was a woman who was an archaeologist at a time when there weren't very many women archaeologists. And
when was that?
It was probably in the kind of the 50s, 60s, the 1950s, 1960s is Marie, 1970s. Was the time, and Marie Wormington was kind of in that time a little bit later, but that was the time we were kind of reminiscing to, as kind of the women who were doing archaeology in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s is the time frame. And so we were talking about, and she was talking about her, she was close to Marie Wormington, this woman who was a really a foremother in the field of archaeology and plains archaeology, and so she was talking about her and some of the struggles that she had, and how Ruth Ann really looked to her to pave her own career, and Marie really helped Ruth Ann with that, to pave her own career. We were also talking about some of the other women, and so it was a really nice gathering, because we were talking about some of these women who had really paved the way for the current generation. But of course, now the current generation are retired, they're in their mid-70s, and those are the women who paved the way for my generation, who are in their mid to late 40s, and then, you know, now we're helping to pave the way for some of the younger professionals as well. So it was at this, you know, this gathering that we had, there was a few different generations there, so it was really neat to see that, and to see how we kind of mentor each other and help each other move through the field of archaeology. And so archaeology is kind of a different field, because you spend a lot of your time out in the field, and so that's kind of hard for women sometimes with families and with children, but these women who went before us really figured that out and were able to manage that and do that in a way that was probably very difficult for them, but they figured it out.
And for someone who's not an archaeologist, what is a trowel?
A trowel has many uses. It is usually what we use to remove dirt when we're working excavating a site, centimeter by centimeter, little bit by little bit, and that's what a trowel is. You can also like mortar a wall with a trowel. There's all sorts of uses for a trowel, but it is the primary tool of an archaeologist.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska speaking with Crystal Alegria and Bonnie Smith, members of the Sisterhood of the Traveling Trowel. This year, the group is offering 3 scholarships to help women archaeologists attend conferences and field school.
Galen Lee is an accomplished musician, most notably winning NPR's 2016 Tiny Desk Concert. She plays the violin in an original way, upright like a cello, to accommodate her small frame. She performs concerts all across the country, but last month she made a detour to the Rock River School in southeastern Wyoming. Tressa Versteeg has the story.
So let me hear if you do a D. So, yep, so.
This is the sound of award-winning musician Galen Lee rehearsing with the Rock River Middle and High Schoolers. In the fall, they listened to Lee's music in class. Then music teacher Megan Goodner encouraged them to reach out to Lee. Here's Bailey Dennett, a 7th grade guitar player, who wrote one of the letters.
I remember saying that she inspired me to do any a girl can do anything a boy can do, that her music was amazing, and that I wish I like had the ideas to make the music.
Bailey Dennett's and her classmates' letters were delivered by teacher Goodner to Lee at one of her concerts in Fort Collins, Colorado. When Lee took questions from the audience, Goodner put one forth.
My question was, what advice do you have for young musicians at, you know, the middle school point in their journey? And I videotaped her response and showed it to them the next day. And that's the closest I thought I would ever get to her. And they thought that was pretty great, too.
After the show, Galen Lee read the letters. And she says it was out of the ordinary.
I was like, what? Like, you know, sometimes you'll play at a school and you'll get a thank you letter after. But this was very different because I was like, boy, I haven't even met these people. So I was like, I really, really want to go to their school.
When the students learned Lee wanted to come to Rock River School, they raised $750 to help get her there. And in early April, their dream came true. They not only got to see Galen Lee perform live, but they also got to join her on stage.
It was an assignment that turned into something much bigger.
The students decorated the stage in wooden pallets intertwined with Christmas lights. They painted a green banner with music notes and Galen Lee in neat black letters to hang as a backdrop. As the rehearsal begins, the students sit in a circle, quiet and still. Goodner says it's because she told them to behave. But it seems that some, like Bailey Dennett, really are a little starstruck.
Yeah, I never really thought that she would come. I mean, I knew there was a possibility, but I never thought that she would really come and be in this school right now. It's really cool.
Lee begins the concert with a question.
So, how many of you know how you normally play a violin?
In the front row, a student responds, "You rest it on your chin and hold your arm straight out." Then Lee explains why she doesn't play that way.
I was born with a physical disability called brittle bones disease. So before I was born, my legs and my arms broke and then healed already to be kind of bent.
Lee has never walked. She says growing up with an electric wheelchair not only allowed her to destroy doors and run over people's toes, but it also gave her the mobility to pursue the things she wanted to do, like music.
So I can't play the violin the regular way, but I can play it up and down like a cello. So that's what I started doing. I adapted it with the help of my teacher, and I'm really grateful that she was willing to experiment with me. And so when we all have dreams, or when our friends have dreams, it's important not to say that it's not possible, but instead to help them figure out a way to do it, right?
The students ask her all kinds of questions.
How long have you had your violin?
Does anybody else in your family play an instrument?
So, did you want to be anything else before you became a musician?
You know what? I didn't think I would be a musician for a living. Something else I care a lot about, which I didn't talk a ton about, is disability rights. People with disabilities, the society isn't totally set up for us yet, but music ended up being just so fun, and I can go to schools and talk about disability rights and how we can all be a part of the solution. So I feel like I'm still able to, connect with that.
Goodner wants her students to connect with that, too.
So I think that holistic character education for them is, it's just part of learning to be a person and walking around in the world and knowing that there's all different kinds of people.
I think music's a really good way to process life. You know, you can always compare yourself, but in reality, you don't have to be the best, you just have to do the best thing that you can do. And a lot of times that people connect with it if it's authentic.
For Bailey Dennett, the 7th grade guitar player, that seems to be the case.
Singing with her, I felt accomplished after that.
Yeah.
And I hope she performs at other schools because they will love her. It's an absolute promise, they will love her.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tressa Versteg.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the show or want to hear it again, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can also find individual segments on that site or sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor.
You can also find our stories and news of the day on our Facebook page, and we invite you to follow all of our reporters on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.